Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Maggs with a brisk 30 minutes on the latest in South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. I'll bring you insightful interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Tuesday, the 23rd of April. Coming up on the program, police on South Africa's kidnapping crisis, growing labor tension in the steel industry, a new case on the employment of people with criminal records, the impact of El Nino on food security, and why Starlink satellite users should be concerned. On our program yesterday, we reported on the alarming number of kidnappings in South Africa, the Institute for Security Studies telling me that a staggering 260% increase has been reported to police over the past decade. In response to that, the Department of Women, Youth and Persons with Disabilities has urged law enforcement agencies to take more decisive action. Well, what sort of decisive action is being taken? More now from Brigadier Athlende Mate, who speaks for the South African Police Service. Brigadier, welcome to you and thank you very much for joining us. A 260% increase. That is a massive spike. I'm assuming that police are very concerned about this.
Well, a very good morning and thank you for the opportunity. Indeed, we are very concerned on the number of kidnappings, especially where ransom demands are being made. Just to take you through how we categorize this particular type of kidnapping. So there's two types of kidnapping. There is kidnapping where the motive is to commit another crime, such as your robbery, your hijacking, your rape and murder. We then have the kidnapping for ransom, where the sole purpose of kidnapping is to extort. So as the police, we picked up this trend quite early as 2017. And that is why in 2018, we established what we call the anti-kidnapping task team, which operates from a national level. We also have competencies at a provincial level. These teams comprise of members under the counterintelligence teams. It consists of members in the specialized units and also detectives that are working around the clock to detect and crack these syndicates that are behind these particular kidnappings.
Of the two categories that you've just outlined to me, which is the most concerning?
Both are concerning, Jeremy, because you find that a lot of people would be kidnapped when another crime is being committed, like I've indicated, your robbery, your hijacking, your murder. But the other one, which is quite concerning, is this one of the kidnapping where ransom demands are being made. It, from our intelligence, it seems as though criminals see it as a quick money solution. So that's how they can make you money fast. It's less dangerous for them as compared to getting involved in your cash in transit heist. So when we picked up this particular crime, it was mostly happening between foreign nationals that come from the same country, your Mozambique, your India, your Pakistanis, and so on. So at that time, it was happening between them where they would kidnap each other for monies and so on. But then as the years went by, we saw South Africans now getting involved in this type of crime, probably because initially South Africans were utilized by these foreign nationals to do the work for them. And that's where then they noticed that, oh, okay, we can also do this. So it's now becoming a new trend in South Africa. But what is also concerning is that it's a very highly organized crime. And that is why our counterintelligence is on top of its game in terms of tracing these particular syndicates and getting to the bottom of who is behind these particular kidnappings. Because before they execute the kidnapping, they do the research. So it wouldn't they wouldn't target a person like you and me, Jeremy. They would target a person who they know is wealthy, would be able to fork out the 5 million or more ransom that is being demanded. So it's highly organized. They do the research. They go on the ground. They search for these families that are highly, that are wealthy, rather. And then they would plan around this particular kidnapping. But what is also comforting is that as the police, we have been able to infiltrate, to penetrate some of these syndicates. In the last 2 years, we have arrested about more than 250 suspects that have been involved in the spate of kidnappings where ransom demands are being made. We had last year, we arrested one of the kingpins that is coming from Mozambique, who was involved in high profile kidnappings in that particular country, but they were also working in South Africa. So we are at a point where this person has been in custody for quite some time. I think it's more than a year. We are just busy with the extradition processes so that he can answer to crimes that have been committed in that particular country.
Well, it's good to hear that you are making progress, but that 260% increase that I mentioned at the start of our conversation is significant. As the trajectory continues, do you think that you will continue to make the kind of progress that you've outlined to me? Or what is difficult about investigating this type of crime?
Well, the first advice I would give to community members, members of the public out there, is firstly not to overshare on social media platforms, because these syndicates are monitoring the social media platforms. They want to know what type of house you live in, what type of cars you drive, where, which schools your children attend. So they use this type of information to plan accordingly, to know who is their next target to kidnap. So first and foremost, the community and members of the public can assist us in that regard to stop oversharing on the social media platforms. On the part of the SAPS, we continue to resource and capacitate these particular units as we see that there is an increase in this particular crime. But what is also important is that we always discourage the paying of ransom. If you or a family member find themselves in such a situation, report it immediately to the police, because paying ransom will not always guarantee that you will find your family member safe and alive. We've got the expertise in the South African Police Service. We've got the Special Task Force, which is the number one SWAT team in the continent, on the continent rather. So in the Special Task Force, they specialize in terms of the rescuing of victims. They specialize in hostage negotiations and so on. But like I've indicated, we've got this anti-kidnapping task team, which consists mainly of members in the counterintelligence. Mm. That we have rescued a number of victims quite recently. I think it was 2 weeks ago, where we rescued two cousins. They were in the Brits area. They were kidnapped on their way to school, and that syndicate was demanding 50 million from the family. We operationalized that information, and we are quite encouraged that the family immediately reported it to the police. We started working on that particular information. We worked closely with the family, and although it took quite some time, it took about 2 weeks until we could trace those particular children, but we managed to trace them, to rescue them. We found them safe and unharmed, and we managed to arrest 8 suspects in that particular All case. Right. So we do plead with members of the public not to engage with these syndicates, to immediately report it to the police so that we are able to penetrate them, trace them, and take them down.
All right, Brigadier, thank you very much for the update. Speaking for the South African Police Service, Brigadier Athlende Mate.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
I want to stay with crime now, and individuals with a criminal record may be faced with significant challenges when seeking employment. I think that's a given. Here in South Africa, employers may legally exclude an applicant from consideration for a position if having a clean criminal record is what is termed an inherent requirement of the job. That phrase, inherent requirement, is important. But what exactly does that mean, and when can an applicant be lawfully excluded for having a criminal record. This issue has been considered in the Labour Court and a decision handed down in the case O'Connor versus LexisNexis. I'm going to explore that in a little more detail now with Labour attorney Patrick Deal. Patrick, welcome to you. And maybe just as a starting point, very simply, why is this case so important?
It's significant mainly because at a sort of a high level, what it does is consider conflicting legal and moral dilemmas in society at a sort of an individual level, an employer level, and at a society level. The relationship in any employment relationship really is between the employer on the one hand, the individual employee in the context of wider society, and why society is represented by laws which are underpinned by moral and principles. And in this case, it has to do with whether or not an employee who has a criminal record can be disqualified from getting a job, and on what basis they can be disqualified, and whether it's justified or not. So that is the overall idea that lies beneath this particular case. And the idea of discrimination is found in various statutes. It's in the Constitution. It's in the Employment Equity Act. And the Employment Equity Act says that an employee cannot be discriminated against on two bases. The first is on the basis of listed grounds for discrimination. And those listed grounds are the familiar ones. There are things like you can't discriminate against people on basis of race, gender, sex, family, ethnic or social origin, etc. So those are known bases for discrimination that society sort of generally accepts. But there are other bases upon which employees may potentially be discriminated against, and that is on what they call arbitrary grounds. And arbitrary grounds are things that are not listed. And if it's a case of an arbitrary ground, the employee who says, I've been dismissed for an arbitrary ground, has to say, explain, what is that arbitrary ground? And for the employer to be able to defend it. And an arbitrary ground could be something, as the name suggests, something that is not in the list, but could be something, I'm not going to employ you because you've got red hair or something like that, which is miles away from something like ethnic or racial, distinctions, characteristics of a person. And so the idea of discrimination, that it offends the dignity of the individual. And the case that we are talking about involved this individual. This fellow applied for a remote work job at LexisNexis, O'Connor, and he was, on the interview, he passed on the merits of getting the case, and he was asked in the preliminary interview whether he had any criminal record. And he said, yes, for theft. I do have a criminal record for theft, but it was 20 years ago. And LexisNexis said, well, okay, we're going to accept you, but it's subject to a criminal check, and which is quite a standard thing. So it was subject to what else came out of the check. And when they checked, they said you did have a criminal record for theft, but it was a lot more than that. It sounds a lot more than that anyway, because there were 6 counts of theft, 1 of fraud, and 2 defeating the ends of justice. So it was a lot more magnified than that. And based on that, the employer said, no, we can't accept this. This basically is more serious than we anticipated when you initially interviewed us and you told us about that. So that on that basis, they did not get into a contract with him. In other words, they would not employ him. And the court decided, actually, that was unfair, that was discrimination, and that LexisNexis had discriminated him, A, because it was arbitrary to say that a requirement of a clean record was an inherent requirement of the job, and in fact, it was not an inherent requirement of the job. So those are the two bases upon which the court decided it.
So explain to me then in what way this is precedent setting and how the ruling could influence future employer policies on criminal background checks.
Well, it could be actually a very important precedent in the sense that the ultimately what this case should have been decided on, I think the focus of the case should have been decided on, this is why it needs to go higher to get a more definite or clearer ruling on all of the issues on these moral dilemmas, this versus, you know, for example, fairness versus unfairness and trust versus honesty. Mm. And trust versus honesty is really what lies at the heart of every employment relationship. And that was what I think what the fault in this judgment was, is that the court found that because the person was working remotely, and even though the person had a criminal record for dishonesty-related crimes, like fraud and theft and so on, he was working remotely, there was not a great need for the employer to fear that he could be untrustworthy. In other words, they were in a way saying to the employer that, you know, you are worrying too much about this thing. We don't think that you should be worrying about the trustworthiness. And so we're going to make a decision that it's us to decide whether you worried unnecessarily about trust. And so that the case should have been, is what would the impact of the criminal conviction 20 years ago have had on the ability of the employer to trust the applicant? And quite clearly, the employer did not trust it, the applicant. No matter what a court might say, they did not trust this employee because of the record and because the employee had not fully disclosed at the preliminary interview the extent of the severity of the crimes that he'd committed. And I don't think that an external court can determine whether or not an employer should not trust an individual. I think that lies at the heart of the problem that comes out of this thing. And that's what the precedent is that could be problematic in future, where you have a court deciding whether or not an employer can trust an employee at inception of employment and decide not to employ that person. And this is where the tricky moral dilemmas come in, because the ability, you know, there's a sort of saying, as you know, is that beauty in the eye is in the eye of the beholder, but trust is in the mind of the beholder. That you know, no matter, provided that the reason for the mistrust is rational in some way, it's not arbitrary. I think it was not correct to find that it was arbitrary, because it's rational that a person has a criminal record, this dishonesty record, and going to work in an employment relationship was underpinned by honesty. That's perfectly rational to me. It's not arbitrary. And it is an inherent requirement of the job, secondly. So I think that the judgment in this could be tested, or should be tested on this, so there's not the final say on it to set a precedent for the future.
Patrick Deal, I am going to leave it there, and thank you very much indeed for the explanation on what is, as you say, a very important case. Thank you so much indeed.
I'm Simon Brown, host of MoneyWeb Now. Join me every weekday morning at 6:30 on the MoneyWeb website or the app to kickstart your morning with the most up-to-date business, economic, and investing news. I ask CEOs about results, speak to analysts on their favorite stocks, and get to understand the inner workings of the economy. Podcast published just after 7. MoneyWeb Now with me, Simon Brown, to start your day informed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The National Union of Metalworkers has told its members in the steel sector to be ready for what it terms any eventuality, as it is locked in wage talks with employers at the Bargaining Council. The union is asking for an above-inflation wage increase. Joining us now on the program is Phakamile Hlubi-Majola, who speaks for the union. Phakamile, welcome to you. The current negotiation atmosphere at the moment, how do you see it from your perspective? Employers say it's positive, and that you've had a very good round.
Good afternoon, and good afternoon to your listeners. Thank you so much for having me on the show. Yes, so far it has been very positive. We can say that we have been engaging each other. We are hopeful that we will find each other. The demands that we've made as a union is that we are making a proposal for a 3-year wage agreement, with the first year being a 7% increase, and the second, and then a 6% increase for the second and third year. And one of the other demands that we've also made is that whatever increase we secure must be based on the actual rate of pay. In other words, must be based on what workers are actually earning, and not based on the minimum rate. And The one other demand that we've made, which we think is quite important, is the demand around ring fencing 2 billion rand for housing, because these the majority of workers in this sector, unfortunately, are unable to access affordable housing. So we are hoping that in the next round, we will be able to find one another on these demands.
Phakamile, the steel sector itself, I don't need to tell you, has been the victim of declining prices due to an increase in cheap imports into South Africa. No doubt that the industry is on the back foot. While both parties at this point are saying that things are looking good, at some point things might get difficult, surely.
Well, look, on the issue that you've raised regarding the steel industry and its issues around the poor performance, the fact of the matter is that as union, we've actually been thinking about that, which is why the demand is 7%, which is, you know, obviously it's above inflation, but we also have to make sure that workers are taken care of. But if you look at the agreement, it's actually 1% more than what we settled on in the last period. So we're not asking for too much. We think we're being very reasonable. And if you compare that to the performance of the sector, how CEOs have been rewarded, how their standard of living is extremely high compared to that of workers, we really think that what we're submitting is very fair.
Phakamile Hlubi-Majola, speaking for the National Union of Metal Workers. You're listening to MoneyWeb at midday, and let's move on. And Starlink users in South Africa will reportedly have their satellite internet services terminated at the end of the month due to violation of its terms and conditions. I want to explore that in a little bit more detail now. And joining us is Jan Vermeulen from the platform My Broadband. And Jan, firstly, before we talk about the termination, just very briefly, tell me, how does the Starlink technology itself work?
Sure. Starlink is a low Earth orbit satellite system. And what that means is it orbits around the Earth a lot closer than a geostationary satellite does. An example of a geostationary satellite is DSTV, for example, or other communication satellites. Now, those geostationary satellites are much further away from the surface of the Earth, and thus that causes them to be much slower than a low Earth orbit system like Starlink. And so, in essence, yes.
So, could you explain then for me the terms and conditions that have reportedly been violated by South African users? Why, in other words, has the service been terminated?
Yes, so this is where we get into the hairy territory of the various regulations that each nation gets to make around its airspace. So to regulate how wireless systems operate in a country, every communications regulator issues spectrum licenses. And so you can't just launch a wireless service in a country without the appropriate spectrum licenses, unless you're using free-to-use spectrum bands. So Wi-Fi and Bluetooth are an example of technologies that use open bands that you don't need a license for. But when it comes to satellite communications, you usually need some form of license. And the bottom line is Starlink has not got licenses in every country where it operates. And South Africa is officially listed without a launch date. So it's a long story how we got here. We used to have a estimated launch window for South Africa, but we got pushed down the priority list. That's a representation of the fact that Starlink has not gone through all the regulatory processes here in South Africa and all the bureaucracy that goes with that. And as a result, it's technically unlawful to operate Starlink in South Africa. And it's got a choice, really. It either needs to switch off or risk breaking the law. And breaking the law means it potentially exposes itself to pretty crippling fines. I think it's like 10 million rand a day or something like that, that you can expose yourself to. So what Starlink has been, and how it landed in this situation, is Starlink has what it calls a roaming product. It's got a global roaming product and it's got a regional roaming product. So for example, if you order a Starlink kit from Europe, you can activate the global roaming product and use it anywhere in Africa. Or you can buy a kit in, say, Rwanda or Mozambique or Eswatini amongst our neighbors that already have Starlink active before us. And you can then activate a regional roaming subscription at a bit of an extra cost. But it's cheaper than the global roaming subscription. And then you could use Starlink in South Africa. But as I've just explained, that was technically unlawful. And so this has now come to Starlink's attention, and it's been forced essentially to cut people off. So in Zimbabwe, the regulator specifically reached out to Starlink and told it needs to cut people off until they sort out the licensing stuff. In South Africa, I don't think that's what's happened. I think this is just kind of cutting South Africans off is just a larger consequence of Starlink trying to do the right thing across the continent. And so I don't actually know if Starlink is even in conversation with our regulator at this stage. They weren't a couple of months ago. So it's not that ICASA has gone to Starlink and said, you must shut off or else. This is just Starlink going, well, we want to, you know, play nice with regulators around the continent. That includes South Africa. And so we're going to switch off now.
And Jan, do you have a sense of how many users there are in this country and what percentage of those users would be affected by the termination?
All of them are going to be affected if this goes through as written on the notice that Starlink gave to them. And we're talking thousands, well over 10,000. You know, it's been difficult because it's such a black market that it's difficult to put a number on it. So, you know, we might be even talking tens of thousands. And while that sounds like a drop in the ocean compared to South Africa's whole broadband user base, I think it's important to consider that these are historically underserviced areas where people have been using Starlink. These are people that have either been ignored or where it's financially just impossible to provide services to them, and where they might not even have proper cellular services, where their houses are on their farmland or something like that. I even know of government departments, of fast food chains and other businesses that have been bringing in Starlinks to extend their services, provide better services in those areas. I can't name them, unfortunately, because I don't want to get them in trouble, but those are also going to go away, and that impact is going to be felt until there's a reasonable alternative to something like Starlink in those areas. So while there is satellite connectivity, it's not nearly as fast as low Earth orbit systems and therefore not nearly as cost effective. And so this really tremendously impacts people who are most vulnerable to something like this. For those of us in the cities, having Starlink be switched off is no skin off our nose, because we've got a choice of four, you know, different 5G networks and like all the fiber that we can eat. This is really disproportionately affecting people who have no other options.
And I'm going to leave it there, Jan Vermeulen. Thank you very much indeed from My Broadband. And just before we depart today's show, let me remind you of our online poll on the program yesterday. We were talking in some detail about a month without load shedding. I was in conversation with the chairperson of Eskom. And my question to you yesterday is, do you see this as a real recovery, something like 25, 26 days without load shedding? Do you see this as system manipulation, particularly ahead of the general election on May the 29th? Or simply, and as I look out of the window right now, is this just more sunshine? We've been blessed in that response. Well, the majority of our respondents are a little more cynical in that respect, saying that the system is being manipulated in a pre-election move, well over 80% as far as that is concerned. On the poll today, we're going to focus on the kidnapping crisis. I was talking to a representative from the South African Police Service a little earlier, quoting figures from the Institute for Security Studies, saying that in the past 10 years or so, there has been a 260% spike in kidnappings. What's your take on that? Are you concerned? Are you taking precautions? Or do you have kidnap insurance? If you have a view on that, I would invite you to go to our MoneyWeb on Twitter X page, or you can also visit the poll on LinkedIn, and I will bring you the results on the program tomorrow. That's where we are going to leave it. MoneyWeb at midday. We are live at noon weekdays, then published as a podcast. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.